So we're going to begin in Exodus chapter 26, and we're going to start with verse 7. Then you shall make curtains of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. You shall make 11 curtains in all. The length of each curtain shall be 30 cubits, and the width of each curtain 4 cubits. The 11 curtains shall have the same measurements. Then you shall join 5 curtains by themselves, and the other 6 curtains by themselves. And you shall double over the 6th curtain at the foot of the tent, at the front of the tent. You shall make 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that is outermost in the first set, and 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that is outermost in the second set. You shall make 50 clasps of bronze, and you shall put the clasps into the loops and join the tent together so that it will be a unit. The overlapping part that is left over in the curtain of the tent, the half of the curtain that is left over, shall lap over the back of the tabernacle. The cubit on one side and the cubit on the other of what is left over in the length of the curtain of the tent shall lap over the sides of the tabernacle on one side and on the other to cover it. You shall make a covering for the tent of ram skins dyed red, and a covering of porpoise skins above. And so now we get construction instructions to make these pieces of goat hair. They're curtains, is the word that gets used by the New American Standard. And there's going to be 11 of them. Each of them is going to be 4 by 30 cubits, which corresponds to 6 foot by 45 foot. Now the linen pieces that were made in the first 6 verses were 6 foot by 42 feet. So they're 3 feet longer. Okay? And instead of making 10, we're making 11. And so you join them together, God said, 5 in one group and 6 in another. So you've got these pieces sewn together. The 6th one is to be doubled over, and it's to go at the back of the tent. There in verse 9. I want to make sure I read that right. I'm sorry, at the front of the tent. That's what I thought, but my brain said back there for a second. So it doubles over at the front of the tent. So the length has one extra 6-foot piece doubled over, and that's going to go over the front of the tent as will hang down just a little bit as in the construction, which doesn't really show that on our drawing. Once again, just like when we made the linen pieces, put 50 loops on the sides, and we're going to make clasps to join them together, and they're to be made of bronze to join this as one unit. That overlapping part in verse 12, he says again, that half curtain will lap over the back of the tabernacle. That's where I went wrong. Verse 12. The overlapping part that is left over in the curtains of the tent, the half curtain that is left over shall lap over the back of the tabernacle. So it's that does go at the back. And then in verse 13, he said, the cubit on one side and the other side of extra length, lap it over the sides to cover it. So the end result is, and you can look at the drawing, and they show it there. The first piece, the one we talked about in the first 6 verses last time, are the colored piece that you see here on the edge. That's, you can see it's the first one down on the structure. Then the next one back, the white one, is the one of goat's hair. And you can see that it sticks down a little bit longer on the sides because it is 3 feet longer. And so you've got an extra bit of material so that you're covering that entire first layer with this covering of goat's hair. Does that make sense? Is that putting that in your thinking to visualize all that? And then he says in verse 14, then make a covering for the tent first of ram's skin dyed red, And they said that would be like a very high quality leather, so that would be a rich piece. But it goes in as a covering for the whole tent. God gives no dimensions that are recorded through Moses on the size of this red, dyed red ram skin piece of leather that they're to construct, but it's to cover the whole thing. And then above that, then God says to use what the New American Standard says is porpoise skins. I've seen some other kinds of sea animals listed as what that might mean, but it's a sea animal. Their skins would be going, covering the whole thing on top. So there's four layers on top, making the roof, if you will, of the tabernacle. And of course, there has to be some conjecture that goes into what all of that would, in appearance, would be, because nobody snapped a Polaroid of it back in the day. So we have to take what information we have and add what we need to visualize at least what it possibly might have looked like. And so last time we saw a linen piece to make this covering. Now we see goat's hair on top of the linen, and then dyed red leather on top of that, and then the porpoise skins or the sea animal skins on top of that. Questions, comments, thoughts?
Kind of strange. My ESV says, rather than porpoise skins, it says goat skins.
For the last one?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. That, I didn't run into goat skins. When I was looking, I ran into manatee and something else.
Badger?
Well, the ones I ran into that stuck in my brain were all sea animals.
Waterproofing.
And it made sense to me to be a waterproof skin. However, I'm fairly certain that leather's at least initially waterproof, so I don't know why it would have to be a sea animal. I'm not going to... The places I look, they almost seem tentative in what they wanted to say.
The note I have in my Bible says, or of dolphin skin, it has manatee in the actual script, or of dolphin skins, or of fine leather.
So there's lots of possibilities there for that top coating, top layer. Okay, so it was an animal.
We also exclude what he's already said. So
it's not going to be the rams, or he'd say it again, right? Good point. So, is that the main point of this tabernacle?
No.
So, I mean, my curiosities and my intentions for the class, I want to bring as much as I can so we can visualize it as much as possible. But at the same time, we begin to get a few things out of this. That this was a very skillfully made tabernacle. And it wasn't just skillful in terms of it was going to be very functional. It was very skillful in terms of it was going to be impressive. In terms of something, if you would see it and look at it. Even in the task of carrying it from place to place, you would have to be impressed as you're carrying some of the things that we're going to talk about next, boards and sockets. You'd have to say that this is something. First of all, it was going to be heavy. I mean, imagine just the candelabra. The minimum value I found for a talent of gold is 70 pounds. The highest was somewhere around 110 or 120. The most common I found was 75, so that's what I went with when I calculated the value of the gold. But just the candelabra is more than a one-man job if you're going any distance. And so that's the way it would be. Good comments. Anything else?
Does it say anywhere how long it would take them to even build this thing? Yeah.
Well, it wasn't overnight, but I'm trying to remember. I've read through the rest of the book, and there was some information over in Deuteronomy, no, Leviticus, and but I don't recall a length of time, but it might be there, and I just don't have it in my head today. Well, they had a lot of people. I mean, they had a big workforce. So I don't think they sat around for 10 years building this. I mean, I think it came right together. There's another thing that we have to remember here. God later on, in not only Exodus but other places, he's going to name a few people that he wants to work on it. And as they moved across the wilderness, we get out all the information to go. They went this many miles, and it would have taken them this many days, and all that. But we have to remember that they didn't move across the wilderness on their own. They moved across the wilderness by the might and power of God. I mean, this whole thing is a miracle. So we can't count out the possibility that God, you know, I've built a few things in my life. I've constructed a few projects. I've done a few of these things. And, you know, I look at it and I go, you know, this isn't going to be too bad. I can do this. You know, and about halfway through, you're going, why did I ever start this? I'm too far along to throw it away, but I really am ready to. And so, you know how things go when we humans do things. And I'm guessing that things went together for them very easily as compared to how things sometimes go. Does it mean it was a short time? No, but I think they had God working with them as they built it, and he would have enabled them to be efficient at a minimum. It might have even been a supernatural speed. I do not know.
Think how dark it would be inside. No windows.
Yeah, no windows inside. Yeah, that candelabra had a job to do. And I'll add one more thing. It's just a comparative note. This tabernacle is a lot more elaborate, and we don't know how crude or how refined it was. But in the 40 days that Moses is here on the mountain, what are the people doing? Remember? What do they make? It didn't seem like it took them very long to do that, did it? So I'm sure that when they're doing something that God has commanded them to do, that they're going to be at least as efficient as they were in their bent toward an evil golden calf to worship.
Mm-hmm. There as well. And so what it does is it kind of gives us a picture that this isn't just any old material. It's something that would have to have been harvested in the seed, which would have been a very expensive and dangerous endeavor, which would cause it to be more expensive. So that's one thing that I noticed, that as we progress toward the Holy of Holies, there is more weight and more separation from the outside world, which is mm-hmm. reminiscent of God's holiness and his separateness. And then the second thing that I was thinking was that God is so precise in his description and prescription of how he is wanting to be worshipped, down to the measurements, that we can even, you know, 3,500 years later be able to picture what this looked like, and if we needed to, we could come up with some semblance of what it would have looked like because he was so precise with how he wanted to be worshipped. So God's worship is not something that we should treat lightly. It is precise. It is specific, and that's how he wants to be approached.
Yeah, and adding to that, not saying something contrary to what you just said, but even adding to what you just said, we also know that from what we saw in Hebrews, that the tabernacle built here wasn't just, oh, this is what I want for a tabernacle on earth. It also mirrored what was already in heaven. And so, yeah, this is highly important to God. The other thing I would say about the materials used, they're out there on a mountain. And it's not, no matter which mountain you think it was, and I'm very convinced it's the one we talked about in class.
Midian.
What's that?
Midian.
Well, it's over in Midian. I get this name out of my head, and I have to get it back in every once in a while. El Laws is it how it ends. What's the first word? I don't remember. But it's the one that Wyatt went to, and I think they made a pretty good case for it being on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba. This is pretty desolate. I mean, at least today, it's mostly rocks. And so here they are to build this in an area where if they had to go gather the materials, that would not have been easy in every case. And so I'm fairly confident that a lot of the spoils taken with them from Egypt were taken by God's intent to be materials that they would use then in building the tabernacle. And almost certainly that included the linen, because that's something that the Egyptians were known for, was making this fine linen. So, yeah, this, if we start looking at this like building our house, we're missing something huge, because this is a structure built by the direction of and for the purpose of worshiping the one true living God. And we ought to have a lot of respect for that and realize it's not just a building project. So let's go on with chapter 26. I'm going to read verses 15 through 30. And now we're going to get to some of the structure that will be supporting these tent coverings and so on that we've been talking about. God's telling Moses again, of course, he's still got to carry all this back down to the people. They're up on the mountain, remember that. Then you shall make the boards for the tabernacle of acacia wood, standing upright. 10 cubits shall be the length of each board, and 1.5 cubits the width of each board. There shall be 2 tenons for each board, fitted to one another. Thus you shall do for all the boards of the tabernacle. You shall make the boards for the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side. You shall make 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets under one board for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under another board for its 2 tenons. And for the second side of the tabernacle, on the north side, 20 boards, and there 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board, and 2 sockets under another board. For the rear of the tabernacle to the west, you shall make 6 boards. You shall make 2 boards for the corners of the tabernacle at the rear. They shall be double beneath, and together they shall complete. To its top, to the first ring. Thus it shall be with both of them. They shall form the 2 corners. There shall be 8 boards with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets. 2 sockets under one board and 2 sockets under another board. Then you shall make bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards of the one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the side of the tabernacle for the rear side to the west. The middle bar in the center of the board shall pass through from end to end. You shall overlay the boards with gold, and make their rings of gold as holders for the bars. And you shall overlay the bars with gold. Then you shall erect the tabernacle according to this plan which you have been shown in the mountain. So now you all know what the tabernacle looks like, right? Well, I've got a couple of things to show you. First of all, talk about tenons. I'm not a woodworker, but I like reading about building projects. And tenons are the way that the guys that want to be a little bit old style in their craftsmanship and want really strong board joinery, that's one of the things they like to use. And the one I hand out today shows a board And it's intended to represent what it would have been in the tabernacle, and shows tenons on it. And that's the two rectangular pieces that are cut down in size, but they're made so they could go inside of, in this case, silver sockets. In wood construction, a lot of times you would have a tenon where one board goes inside and then another board will have a corresponding opening for that tenon to go in, and when you glue all that together, it gets very, very strong. So when you hear tenons, you can think about that. And then when you think about the sockets, they're made of silver, and there's two sockets per board, one for each tenon sticking down. And then in the drawing that I gave you, this person imagined they had kind of a connecting mechanism between the sockets, kind of like a puzzle. When you build a puzzle, one piece locks into another. It had something similar to that. And then if you were to put it all together, the drawing I gave you the other day, that light colored piece down around the bottom would be the row of silver sockets that these boards are placed down into to form the outside three of the sides of the tabernacle. Now, the boards in verse 16, well, verse 15, they're to be made of acacia wood. They're going to stand upright. They're to be made 10 cubits long. And so we're estimating that to be 15 feet. And 1.5 cubits are almost 24 inches. If it's a 15-inch cubit, that'd be 23 or so inches wide. And so these are a foot and a half wide. That's pretty wide for a board. And 15 foot tall. We don't know how thick they are. But that's how they are. There's to be two tenons made on each board, as you saw in the drawing I showed you. And you fit those two each together so that all the boards are going to have that. And so you're going to have 20 boards on the south side and with 40 sockets of silver. And so that's what you see happening here. And so that makes that length about 40 feet, just a little less. 20 boards, about 2 foot to a side. I can't multiply, can I? That's almost 50 feet. 20 times 2, still 40. 40 feet, okay. And on the north side, 20 boards and 40 sockets of silver. And to the west, they're going to have 6 boards, but you got 2 more for covers, so you've got about 16 feet there. What I read, most people think the building was 15 foot wide, 15 foot tall, and the Holy of Holies was 15 foot long, making it a cube. And then the other piece would have been 25 foot long, the holy place. And so we've got these two boards for the corners, and there was some sort of special way that these corners were doubled over, and what the guy that did this drawing thinks is those corner boards overlap on top of the end boards. You can see that back there. It's not real bold in there, but it's there. There was something special about those corner boards that isn't real clear to me. But we form the corners. Now, they're also, when we start into verse 26, you start making some bars. And these bars run horizontally, which you can see those on the sides here. That's what they're trying to represent on the sides, is those boards run horizontally. And there is some sort of attachment for those to the vertical boards. So when you put all these boards in, it's going to hold everything together. And, oh, by the way, all of this is overlaid with gold. So can you imagine what this might have looked like? You've got this silver base of tenons laid out on the ground all the way around. And you've got these vertical boards, 15 foot about tall, and you've got the horizontal boards holding them together. And so before you start covering it, can you imagine what that looked like in the sun? All that gold and silver, be very impressive. And then in verse 30, he says, erect the tabernacle according to the plan I have shown you. So once again, we get that statement on the mountain. Questions or comments about the boards and the bars and even the holders for the bars? They're all gold.
It's hard to imagine him having to write all that stuff.
Well, yeah, and you know, what miracle was being done here? Was Moses going, slow down, slow down? Or was he even writing it down? Maybe God was just downloading it to him and he would remember it all by God's own miracle. I don't know. And then there's this constant reminder that we see starting to come up. And put it together according to the plan I showed you on the mountain. So there's some pieces and parts here that we can only begin to imagine, let alone accurately talk about what it was in terms of the way God was transmitting this to Moses. Yes, sir?
Yeah, it makes you wonder where they found those big trees. I mean, you picture the region they're in is kind of desolate and desert-like, but these are pretty big boards they used.
Yeah, in the book that I've been looking at to help me with some of this, I've shown it to you before. And this isn't my only reference by any means, but this is a good starting point. I don't want to say anything negative about the book. He does, I don't know what word I want to use. He makes a lot out of the materials used and so on in comparison to Christ. And they're fun comparisons. I think it might be a little bit of a stretch sometimes where he goes with some of that. But he says that the acacia wood was a wood that was grown a little bit north of here, that it was a dry weather tree, but they would grow very, very slowly, were very, very strong, and pretty much like I would think of cedar for a cedar chest or redwood for a deck. They were pretty much, even after processed, very resistant to weathering, insects. They just were naturally a long-lived material to build things out of.
There are a number of desert species that are like that. Go down to Phoenix, they got a tree called ironwood that grows, like you say, very slowly, but it's considered so tough that it gets that name ironwood.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard to work? Okay. Yeah. Well, it makes sense that it would be called ironwood.
The other, not to imply any special meaning to it, is the fact that he uses directions. It's the north side, south side, west side, and it makes you think that there's supposed to be a little bit about which way is this thing supposed to be oriented when it's set up.
You would expect every time you set it up that the Holy of Holies would be to the east,
yeah.
So that the north side would be the north side, the south side would be the south side, and so on.
Again, the detail.
The detail. Okay, anything else? Good questions and comments.
Hopefully I don't see on the west side where the door is.
Well, we're getting there.
Yeah.
We're not there yet. And even the next passage isn't there yet. But we're not far away from it. I don't know that we'll get there today, but we might. So let's go back to chapter 26, and we will look at 31 through 37. And this is the veil and screen. So then God gives him the next piece for the tabernacle. You shall make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet material of fine twisted linen. It shall be made with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman. You shall hang it on four pillars of acacia overlaid with gold. their hooks also being of gold on four sockets of silver. You shall hang up the veil under the clasps and shall bring in the ark of the testimony there within the veil. And the veil shall serve for you as a partition between the holy place and the holy of holies. You shall put the mercy seat on the ark of the testimony in the holy of holies. You shall set the table outside the veil and the lampstand opposite the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south. And you shall put the table on the north side. You shall make a screen for the doorway of the tent, a blue and purple and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen, the work of a weaver. You shall make five pillars of acacia for the screen and overlay them with gold, and their hooks also being of gold, and you shall cast five sockets of bronze for them. It's actually in this passage. I thought it was in the one after. But the first thing he instructs is a veil to be made of blue and purple and scarlet material with cherubim of a skilled workman. This matches that first layer that we put around and over the tabernacle as a tent. And so we're doing the same material again. It's to hang on four pillars of acacia, and they're to be with a gold overlay and to have golden hooks and four sockets of silver at the base to hold them. So instead of two, they get four. So the pillar is probably more square-like, have four tenons down there, and so it would have four sockets to hold it. And then this veil is to be hung under the clasps that are put with these pillars. And inside, the Ark of the Testimony is to be placed inside the veil. So we have now created the holy place and the Holy of Holies. God said it's a partition between the two, and the Ark of the Testament goes, Ark of the Covenant goes in the Holy of Holies, and the mercy seat is to be placed on the Ark. The table of showbread is to be put on the north side, on the outside of the veil, so in the holy place, and the lampstand was to be on the opposite side, which is the south. And then also, God also gives directions to make a screen for the door of the temple. So the side that was open that he hadn't given any instructions for yet, he said, we're going to make that screen or the door to be made of blue and purple and scarlet again, fine twisted, the work of a weaver. And so that too is to be very similar to what you see on the rest of this inner fabric covering for the tabernacle. And you're to have five pillars of acacia with gold overlay to hold up this screen. And there's to be hooks of gold with five sockets of bronze for them. So I've got a question for you. What was the purpose of the veil? I know we haven't really talked about that. We're going to get more of that in Exodus, but just from what we already know and what we already have been taught in previous times, what's the purpose of that veil? Well, that's right, but let's back up a step. What's the purpose?
To basically separate God from...
Okay. So, who's going to go behind the veil? The high priest. Once a year, on the Day of Atonement, he would sprinkle blood on the mercy seat for the purpose of showing sacrifice and bringing to God their sins for his mercy seat. He would sprinkle this blood on for his sins as well as for the sins of the people. So what is the relationship of the priest to God and to man? Think about the priest. Think about God. Think about men. What's the relationship of the priest to God and men?
He's an intercessor.
He is to bring God to the people in terms of direction, in terms of things God tells him to bring, in terms of God's leadership of the people, and then he takes anything the people desire to say to God or to ask of God back to him. Now, that's not to say there weren't other prayers and other things that happened, but that's his role. And I want to set this up a little more by asking you a question. Do you think Jesus respect? Now, we're going to tabernacle Old Testament, right? Time of Jesus, what's the worship place? Huh?
Temple.
The temple. Is it the original temple? Huh? No. Solomon built the original temple, right? It was destroyed, looted, Babylon, and so on. So how did we have a temple in the time of Jesus? Anybody know? Herod built it. Herod saw fit to reestablish worship in Jerusalem, Jewish worship, and so he built a temple, and boy, was it a temple. It was really something. Do you think Jesus respected Herod's temple? I got to know.
I mean, go ahead and let, I mean, I know he didn't. His anger, he put the tables and because they turned it into a marketplace.
John 2, 14 through 17. Let's read that. John 2, 14 through 17. I'll start with 13. The Passover was near. The Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables. And he made a scourge of cords and drove them out of the temple. With the sheep and the oxen, he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, "Take these things away. Stop making my father's house a house. I'm sorry, making my father's house a place of business." Now, certainly we're here, and what the Jews are doing is ripping off the people in the financially, so that they can have the right thing to make a sacrifice with to worship God. And so they're perverting God's worship, right? So certainly that was a piece of Jesus' anger. But what did he call the temple? There's at least a certain level of respect there. I mean, that this place was functioning as the center, the temple, for the worship of the Jews. And I think we can add more to that before we're done. When Solomon built the temple, we have the Holy of Holies overtaken by the Spirit of God, the Ark of the Covenants there, and so on. But that kind of came to an end when the temple was overtaken and Solomon's temple was destroyed and the Ark of the Covenant was carted off. And so we don't have quite the same level of visible godly presence in the Holy of Holies. But I want to tell you a little bit about the temple, that, and specifically the veil that was put in the temple that Herod built. According to Jewish tradition, the Talmud, which is rabbinic, the rabbi's opinions and thoughts and teachings, directions, In the time of Herod's temple, the veil was 60 feet long, which is considerably larger than the tabernacle. It was 30 feet wide, the veil was, and it was 4 inches about thick. It was so heavy that according to their tradition, when they wanted to bring the veil down or to put it up, it took 300 priests to get the job done. This thing is heavy. And it's believed to be really two veils. They couldn't figure out, when Herod enlarged the temple, what they didn't know was the curtain supposed to be on the inside side, on the Holy of Holies side, as a veil, or to be on the holy side as a veil. So they took one cubit length and put one on both sides. And we knew we had one in the right place. So they were trying hard to do some things right if the Talmud is correct. So imagine that veil construction. It's really two pieces. It's very thick. It's very heavy. And I want to look at Matthew 27, verses 50 to 51, which is just what we were talking about a minute ago. Matthew 27, 50 to 51. This is the time of the crucifixion. The events are happening, and this is what happens in the temple, and you know what's coming. In verse 50 it says, "And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split." What's the significance of that?
Well, the barrier between man and God was suddenly done away with, the human barrier, and thus giving access to the Holy of Holies.
The Holy of Holies was no longer veiled from anybody, was it? This symbolized access to God. I don't think we should also go by those words too quickly. The veil was torn what?
To bottom.
That is, if you wanted to go in and tear the veil, you'd have to have a pretty good ladder to get to the top. This was no human action. Now, this is God himself from his position from above tearing that veil and opening up our access to him. So the game changes completely. And as we're talking about the veil, I wanted to bring these things out. Go over to Ephesians 1. We're going to look at verses 13 and 14. Ephesians 1, verses 13 and 14. Here's what it says. And by the way, I always struggle to take a verse or two out of Ephesians 1, because Ephesians 1 is so loaded and so rich, and there's so much context, and it's hard not to teach for a couple hours out of Ephesians 1. But just taking these pieces, "In him you also, after listening to the message of truth, the gospel of your salvation, having also believed, you were sealed in him," the him here is Christ, "with the Holy Spirit of promise, who is given as a pledge of our inheritance with a view to the redemption of God's own possession to the praise of his glory." And so as they came into Christ through the truth of the gospel, through the belief that it's clear as we look at the rest of Ephesians 1, is itself a gift of God, emphasized again in Ephesians 2, they were what? Sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise. That which seals us in Christ. That seal has a very definite function of being the sign of approval and the sign of preservation for the believer. Sealed. It's done. It's complete. And it's God-endorsed, because the seal is the very Holy Spirit of God. And that seal remains in a sealing function in our lives. It's not that it's a one-time seal and then the Spirit's gone. That Spirit remains as a seal. When before, with the veil, to hear from the Holy Spirit of God, where did you have to go? You had to go to the priest. And the priest had to go into the Holy of Holies. And so that is gone. Go over to 1 Corinthians 2. We're going to read verses 3 through 16. 1 Corinthians 2, 3 through 16. First Corinthians 2, beginning with verse 3. And Paul's talking about Christ crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. Yet we do not speak wisdom among those who are mature. I'm sorry, yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, a wisdom, however, not of this age, nor the rulers of this age who are passing away, but we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory, the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for him, has prepared for those who love him. For to us God revealed them through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, so that we may know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. But he who is spiritual appraises all things, yet he himself is appraised by no one. And this is the punchline. This is why I read all those words setting up for this about who God is and what he's done and the role of his Spirit. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he will instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. When the veil was torn, it wasn't just that people now had access to God and to his Spirit, and by extension we know to Christ, who was both God and man. So the Trinity, no, it isn't just that we gained access to the Trinity, but the Trinity burst out of the Holy of Holies and invaded mankind through the grace of God, so that those who believe have within them the very mind of Christ. That veil that we read about in Exodus was very significant. It set the stage for the work of Christ on the cross to have a very visible and physical and real demonstration that God had poured forth his Spirit on mankind through the gospel, through the work of Jesus Christ, and through his grace. Comments? Thoughts? We should not take that to mean that the people of the Old Testament came up short. God was very gracious to them. God honored their faith. When we look in the book of Hebrews, in chapter 12, we see the foundations that those men laid of faith and how God worked in their lives and in their faith to really honor them and to give them a rich relationship with him that was carried forward by the faith. And then the salvation of Christ then is applied to them after the fact, so that they have the full grace of God, the forgiveness of sins poured out on them through Christ. But the world we live in is precious. Not the world, not its systems, not the evil in it, but the times of this world that we live in are precious because our relationship with God is so, so, so much open and better and personal because of the having the mind of Christ, having that veil lifted from our minds so that we can see who God is. And boy, you and I ought to be really thankful of the inclusion of the Gentiles. Because God's focus on we Gentiles is a very precious watershed moment in scriptures and in what it means to be a Gentile in the world. And God has been very kind to us. Well, I also had some things down here about cherubim. And we won't do that today. We will start there next time. I'll spend some time opening up because we see these cherubim showing up. And what are cherubim? And when we get done talking next time, you'll say, wow, what are cherubim? So anyway, we'll do our best to bring what we can to it. But understand, there's a lot more that we don't know, and there's almost nothing we know. But we'll talk about them and have a good time with it. See you next time.